Is it, do you think, basically a functioning oxymoron to wish people a happy Remembrance Day? Lest we forget is, of course, pretty much the mantra for the occasion of Remembrance Day in our culture. The desire that we would continue to honor by remembering those that fought in the name of, and in many cases, and perhaps especially on Remembrance Day, those that died in the name of the country in which we live. I realize that this can be a complicated intersection for all sorts of reasons. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I did feel, as I was reflecting on this and writing about it, I did feel like I should say that, for the record, personally, I think we do need to remember and honor. And I think we need to include in that process the ongoing questions about whether any of those deaths were in fact necessary in the pursuit of peace. That's not a simple or an obvious question, that one. And I want to begin to explore something this morning that is full of that same complexity. As we've been digging around in the wisdom of Jesus, we've touched on what I've called the myth of redemptive violence. And that idea and language that's not original to me, of course, by way of personally understanding some of the origins of that in my own life and experience, my own cultural and religious history stands in a tradition of pacifism. The tradition of Menno Simons, the former Catholic priest from the Netherlands who became such an influential voice during the same period as the Protestant Reformation and whose followers came to be known as Mennonites. You might know some of those. You might be sitting beside one of those. One of the strong streams of the Mennonite tradition is, of course, peacemaking. And the faculty here in the city that deals with conflict resolution studies at the U of W, for instance, works out of Menno Simons College. And that tradition is visible in our city. I have friends and relatives whose life work has been that of carrying the ideas and skills that have grown out of that tradition into conflicts and conflict zones all over the world. And it's from some of those people that I primarily take my own inspiration when it comes to the very real challenges of not taking on the prevailing thinking about violence, or at least not swallowing it whole without some serious consideration. The thought that live by the sword, die by the sword might have something fundamentally true about it keeps bringing me back to personal as well as collective sorts of questions about the nature of violence. Where does it come from? What shapes it takes? How and why it hides in my own heart and life, how I enact it myself and then justify it, how we could break the cycle of it, all of those kind of questions. And so, to bring this back to that phrase, the myth of redemptive violence, for a moment, and just unpack it a little bit, a myth, at least this is the way I'm going to use that in this phrase, a myth can be simply understood as a guiding story. Just a way of looking at, of thinking about, of acting in the world that can be entered into or summed up in a narrative or story sort of way. We all have them. We all have personal mythologies. We're not always conscious that we have them, and sometimes we only become conscious of them in our own lives when some experience reveals their shortcomings. And then we kind of, a little bit. So, for instance, if we find ourselves, let's say, repeatedly failing to be able to move toward intimacy in relationships, and we start to probe the why of that, we might discover that way back in our childhood somewhere, we were taught that nobody else is going to look out for you. You have to look out for yourself. No one else is looking out for you. You just got to take care of yourself. That is a simply stated mythology, a guiding story. It's a really short, compact version of a mythology. Now, the problem is, in this particular illustration, that it's a short-sighted and broken story doesn't foster an open-hearted life, and when we live without open hearts, we discover that we really can't grow intimacy. So then what happens if we're having an experience like that is we have to go digging around to try to find the roots of that myth in our life, and we have to try to do the work of relearning a different, better story about love and intimacy and caring. So that's kind of the way that works. I'm not thinking of anyone in particular as I tell that story, unless perhaps it's myself. The myth of redemptive violence is so common in our surrounding culture that we might not even notice it, at least not by that name. But it's in the news every day. It shows up in stories about politics, particularly international politics where force is involved. We might not feel like it as Canadians. We might not feel like we hear a lot of "we bomb us, you bomb, we bomb, you bomb us, we bomb you, you bomb us, we bomb you, somebody has to win, so we're going to bomb you" bigger stories about our troops. That's not, at the moment, the predominant story that we hear. But we hear lots of stories about retributive sanctions, which can be understood as the global trade version of "you bomb us, we bomb you." And of course, pretty much every revenge story has this at its heart. The idea that somehow getting even makes the world a better place. At least it makes the world a better place for whoever gets the last word in the cycle of revenge. Or if we're kind of trying to get our head around this, we could watch pretty much any action movie. I recently had occasion to watch the first John Wick movie. In its genre context, this movie generally fared quite well. In fact, it's become what the industry calls a franchise. There's a second and a third movie following the first. Here's a summary of the plot. I did not write this. This is what you get on your first pass. Legendary assassin John Wick, Keanu Reeves, for those of you who've just been panting for a chance to see Keanu Reeves in something not current. Legendary assassin John Wick retired from his violent career after marrying the love of his life. Her sudden death leaves John in deep mourning. When a sadistic mobster and his thugs steal John's prized car and kill the puppy that was a last gift from his wife, John unleashes the remorseless killing machine within and seeks revenge. All right, so when I wrote this next sentence, I was thinking of, the Mennonite's just spinning wildly in his grave right now and going, somebody make that Scottish guy take off his kilt, put on his pants, and get civilized. Personally, I find powerful machines, you know, like John Wick's cherished muscle car, I find them a little bit interesting. But I love my puppy. And so when the ruthless and infantile villain of the film and his sidekick do in the dog, I am not ashamed to say that, first of all, I teared up, and then I wanted to see them pay. Clever, clever filmmakers, hey? The myth of redemptive violence had all the emotional underpinning it needed to just get me to sit through the ensuing 2 hours of escalating violence, cheering for the hard done by killing machine that John Wick becomes, right up to the moment where, totally unsurprising, spoiler alert, having survived the most aggressive attempts on his life and having exacted his own brutal revenge, he rescues another puppy and limps off into the sunset. And although I haven't watched any of them, presumably into the violent sequels as well. So that's kind of the problem with the myth of redemptive violence, isn't it? It doesn't work. It doesn't make the world a better place. It doesn't take violence out of circulation. In June of 2015, following America's withdrawal from Iraq, USA Today ran a piece titled, "We Can't Bomb Our Way to Peace," which pretty much sums up the problem with the myth of redemptive violence. We might be frequently exposed to the arguments that violence can be redemptive, that violence is often justifiable, that it works, but it doesn't really take that deep a look into the heart of what it is to see that when it comes to achieving the peace and stability we claim to desire, It just doesn't work. As an example of the acknowledgement that we can't bomb our way into peace, our experience shows us that using violence to bring about the end or even the dramatic reduction of violence actually seeds future rounds of violence. When I had a chance to spend some time in the Israeli-occupied West Bank of Jordan about 3 decades ago, I got to know some really delightful Arabic people that live there. And in particular, I became friends with the Rantisi family. This family has a big house in Ramallah. It's full of children. A couple of them are their own, but mostly the kids that fill this house are kids that have been orphaned by the conflict in that region of the world. And they're not just kids from the Palestinian side of the conflict. They just welcome children to their care regardless of which side of the battle lines they came from. It took then, and it continues to take, a ferocious determination and a heroic ongoing effort to extend care across those kinds of lines of division and hatred and the constant lobbing of bombs that is the ongoing norm in that part of the world. One of the things that the father of that family, Adi Rantisi, taught me during that month that I was there was that even though violence might put down an existing existential threat in the moment, even though it might keep the enemy from kicking down the door right then, it doesn't help us deal with the violence that we carry inside of us. That violence, even if it recedes for a moment, usually comes back refueled and ready for more. I won't ask anyone to reflect out loud on this. Far too many of us, if we did that, it would be to drag some of our most shameful moments into public, because let's just put it this way. If this all feels too theoretical for you, take a moment and think about the last time you wanted to hurt someone. Because this stuff lives so naturally in our hearts, at least some of our stories would be about confronting those very sorts of feelings inside of us in our interactions with people that we love the most. We would tell stories about trying to tamp down a swell of rage inside us when we were dealing with one of our kids or with our spouse or partner or parent or colleague. We wouldn't be proud of those stories, but they would be true. So, if we wanted to see this from another point of view, we could reflect on stories in which we may have been victims. Also a potentially difficult exercise, but one in which we might find ourselves able to identify what it feels like to be the object of somebody else's irrational hatred. Those stories probably wouldn't mostly be stories about rules or laws or about our societal attempts to shape and constrain our actions. They would be stories about the human heart, about the self. Now, just a quick heads up. If you grew up around certain shapes of Christianity, this is the part where you might expect the preacher to talk about sin, about fallenness, about our inherent wickedness, and how dealing with that wickedness required, wait for it, the violence of God. About how God is the sort of entity that would kill her own kid because of someone else's moral failure. By the way, that particular storyline is so embedded in our collective psyches that it shows up in an oblique way even in that John Wick movie that I mentioned a moment ago. So let me just say this flat out and then we'll come back to it another time. That's not where I'm headed. Because I personally think that that narrative about a violent God is an ancient one that we need to dispense with and move on from. As a species, our ideas about God have always been and always are evolving. And that idea, that notion that God is fundamentally about a violent version of power and that we are just waiting for the other shoe to drop, but that we can be sheltered from God by Jesus getting in the way and deflecting the blow, is not only not helpful, it also doesn't square with Jesus' own teachings about how to take violence out of circulation. More on that in a bit. When Jesus talked about how to deal with violence, his focus was not on making and keeping rules. It was about dealing with the human heart. For the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about some of Jesus' most pithy thoughts about ways to radically and creatively interact with imbalances of power. And the thoughts that we were poking around in particular are found in the record of some of Jesus' teachings that we call the Sermon on the Mount. And in that same powerful collection of wisdom, which is in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, we find this. These are words given to Jesus in that story. You have heard that it was said. Remember what's going to happen whenever the text says you have heard that it was said. Get ready for a new idea. Get ready for a world-altering paradigm shift. You have heard that it was said, you should not commit adultery, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Or Mark chapter 7, it is from within you, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Or if we're going to circle back to Matthew 5 in a passage where Jesus speaks directly to violence, you have heard it said, you shall not murder, and whoever murders is in danger of judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with another without cause shall be in danger of judgment. That last one seriously rains on the parade of my self-righteousness, you know? Like, I would like to think that this whole conversation about taking violence out of circulation is about somebody else. I'm not a violent guy. By personality, I'm more inclined to avoid conflict or to try to dial it down than I am to wade in there swinging. But if I'm going to take the wisdom of Jesus seriously at this point, I'm afraid that I would have to acknowledge that the wide net of that last statement has me in it. So, there's the problem, if you will, that violence seems to be embedded in our world, in our hearts. What to do? Are we back in one of those binary corners again, one of those only two paths situations? Are the available choices either just accept that violence is the way the world is and kind of fold our cards when it comes to the issue, or alternatively, to fight fire with fire and get to work on either being or attaining a bigger weapon than whoever we're in conflict with? Or is there a third way? Rhetorical question, of course. Today, we're going to just touch on that third way as we find it in the vision Jesus casts for a better world. And then next week, we're going to unpack that a little bit more. If we're going to muse about a third way to deal with oppression and violence, we could do much worse than to reflect on the life of Martin Luther King, someone who I believe took the wisdom of Jesus and these things very seriously, and also managed to do a quite remarkable job of interfacing with ancient wisdom and a contemporary problem. In this case, race relations. It was King, speaking as an African-American in a still deeply segregated America, who said, "Hate begets hate. Violence begets violence. Toughness begets a greater toughness. We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love. Our aim must never be to defeat or humiliate the white man, but to win his friendship and understanding." And Jesus, also an oppressed minority, laboring to live freely under both a military overlord and a system of runaway religious oppression, said it this way: love your enemy. From the position of relative privilege that I live with as a white male every day, at this cultural intersection, I don't think I've ever had personally a more astonishing experience of this than when I've encountered the deep grace of so many of our First Nations people in the Indigenous settler conversation. I can't know what that's like from the other side. Like, it's not possible to do that. That's a way of knowing that we can't do as humans. We can learn about, and we need to. We'll talk about this in a moment as well. We can elevate certain things in our life that open us to ideas or perspectives that we don't know by experience, but we can't know them by experience. So there's a way of knowing that is human, that is fundamental to our way of moving through the world, that we have to trust one another with, that we have to actually be willing to come to conflict situations and say, you have a perspective on this that I don't and that I can't have. The only way I can even approach the other perspective in this conflict is to have you bring it to me. Then my appreciation of it can grow. It'll still be limited. I still can't have what you have because it's a lived experience, but I can grow my capacity for that. But that takes an enormous amount of trust. And you know, just for a moment, try to imagine what it costs to offer that possibility from the other side of the conflict, especially if you're offering it as the person or group of people with less power. You might just get kicked right back into the same hole again. So I don't have good language for this, and I didn't try to think of a tidy way to say it in advance. So just to try to describe what it feels like inside of me when I encounter First Nations kindred pouring grace into a conversation that I'm in as a person of settler ancestry. Over and over again, I've had this affective felt experience of, I can't imagine what this costs you, but what a lovely, lovely gift. Priceless, right? Amazing. When Jesus says, love your enemy, when Jesus talks about doing that kind of work, if I was going to put that idea into vernacular, I would just say, that's crazy. That's crazy talk. If we were going to actually live that way, if we were going to enact that, it would be like we have to engage in a quantum leap in the evolution of the human imagination about how things could be. We'd have to move a long, long ways from where we normally live. A philosopher named Philip Kitcher, Kitcher is not a believer. Kitcher is a thoroughgoing secularist. Which becomes important in the quote that I'll read in a moment. Kitcher says that the primary ongoing ethical project of human beings is increasing the amount of responsiveness we have to other people. I'll read that for you again. The primary ongoing ethical project of human beings is increasing the amount of responsiveness we have to other people. And so of this radical vision of Jesus, of love your enemies, Kitcher writes this. When the Jesus of the Gospels commands love of our enemies, the ideal of responsiveness to others is radically extended. People typically excluded from the ethical conversation are given a presence and a voice. So this is Kitcher writing about what happens if we were to enact love your enemies. When the Jesus of the Gospels commands love of our enemies, the ideal of responsiveness to others is radically extended. People typically excluded from the ethical conversation are given a presence and a voice. What are we talking about here? We're talking about white people. Settlers seeing First Nations people in a more empathetic way. We're talking about straight people sharing the mic with gay and trans people. We're talking about men sharing it with women. If we want, really truly want, a more peaceful world, we would have to take into account the needs, the hopes, and the aspirations of those we would rather keep down. I don't know of a nice way to consider that in me or around me. Because it starts with actually seeking to understand my complicity in the problem. It starts with looking inside of me deeply enough that I begin to become aware of who I would rather keep down, who it serves me well to keep down. This whole, it's, I can't remember what the exact content of the stuff that got plastered all over at U of M, it's okay to be white, that thing. Heard a thoughtful person comment on that in the days following the man who, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, it was driving at the time and I didn't stop and write it down, but he's the director of, I believe, Indigenous Medical Studies at the University of Manitoba. Said if the poster had said it's advantageous to be white, it's a leg up to be white, essentially, fine. But it didn't. Why? Well, because to say it's advantageous to be white is to begin to do the work of looking at the problem and going, who is it and how is it that just my being keeps someone down? Don't have time to unpack this far enough, so I'm just going to put it out there as a problem, and we can all do work because we're smart people and we care, and this is ours to do. That can be the short path to just fruitless guilt, which is one of the two binaries that we face when we're dealing with questions of oppression. Do nothing. Experience despair, right? So if we stay in a binary space, we get into this little problem of our liberal, white liberal guilt, let's say, just my whiteness is a problem. The fact that I have white skin is not the problem, it's my whiteness. It's a systemic problem. Oh, guess we're done. Can't change that. Despair. If I want to change it and I can't, deflation. Or I'm inclined to use violent language to illustrate the alternative. I'm just going to take a pass on that. But the alternative is power up, right? Damn straight, I'm white, and the rest of you aren't. So, guess who's in charge here? And if you assail that, I am going to come back at you with rage and power. That's the binary. That's why we're talking about a third way, week after week. Because there has got to be a better alternative than despair or keeping the violence in circulation. And when Jesus says, love your enemies, that's exactly the category of creative thinking about conflict and power that Jesus is trying to get us to engage in. What's the alternative? Because both of those paths clearly keep violence in circulation. You might kind of say, well, how does folding your cards as a person who realizes that they have power that could be abused, how is that violence? Well, the question is not how is it violence so much as where's the violence directed? Because the violence is directed inward in that part of the story. Short version of depression is just like rage turned inward, often is not, right? This is also violence, not a solution. Not a solution at all. If we really want a more peaceful world, we have to somehow begin to do the work of taking into account the needs, the hopes, and the aspirations of those we would rather keep down. And that is a work that, if it's going to make it into the heart of our society, has to start much closer to home. It actually has to start in our own hearts. Next week, we're going to probe the practicality of that a bit more. I think it's important to actually wrestle with whether an idea like that could ever be anything but a noble fantasy or an unpracticable guiding story. Peace.